Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags with 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. Interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Tuesday, the 9th of July. Coming up on the programme, how the DA plans to sit in opposition in Gauteng. Staggering new numbers out on our poor savings rate, the use of drones in enhancing agricultural productivity, and the power of digital technology when it comes to medical diagnosis. The Democratic Alliance saying it will not form part of Gauteng Premier Panyaza Lesufi's cabinet following a failure to reach an agreement with the ANC. The party saying it was not satisfied with the party's offer, insisting it was unreasonable and unfair. Salim Simanga is the DA leader in the province and joins me first up on the programme. So initially then, what type of opposition are you going to be?
Well, I think we're going to be a very robust opposition. We are sitting now with numbers that are in our favor because this administration doesn't have a majority. Therefore, they cannot steamroll anything and everything past us. We're going to be very robust in terms of what we are going to be asking for, what we are going to be scrutinizing, the budget, the report. You would remember that in the previous term, we have had the situation where, you know, reports would be held back and they would use their majority to not make certain things see the time of day. We are going to make sure that none of that happens now going forward. But we're not going to be petty. We are not just going to try and, you know, disrupt the running of government just because, you know, we can call for motions of no confidence and things like that. We're not about that. We're about saving the people of Gauteng. And if they do come up with programs and budgets that talk to that, they will get our support. If not, they will not have a good time at all.
It would have been a whole lot easier, though, to do this within some form of coalition.
Well, you would think that is the case, and this is what we wanted to do. But when you're talking about a coalition, our understanding and the ANC's understanding of it are two different things. There needs to be a power sharing here. I mean, there's only about a 6% difference between us, and none of us have gotten over 35%. With the ANC coming in at 34, we're coming in at 28. They wanted to then co-opt us and actually then ending up giving us very useless and hollowed out portfolios, as we've now seen the evidence thereof in terms of what has been given to other parties. And therefore, you become just a rubber stamp to the ANC's decision. And that's not what we wanted to do. That was not our intention or even our understanding. The ANC is actually then, if you were to then analyze the cabinet that has been put forward, you'd realize that they're controlling 98% of the budget of the legislature of Gauteng, allowing only about 2% to just go into these hollowed out portfolios. And this is what, you know, for us would have been a great concern. We've made a promise to the people of Gauteng. We've promised to rescue and to make some reforms in government. And therefore, if you are just going to be there to rubber stamp and not even get your proportional share of the votes, then what you're sitting with, you're just sitting as a lame duck, is just rubber stamping decisions. Mm. And this is not what we wanted to do or our understanding of the situation.
You were quoted as saying that the Democratic Alliance was strong-armed into opposition. What does that mean?
Well, I don't, not to say that we have been strong-armed. We've decided on our own that we're not going to go into a co-option. We're not going to be co-opted by the ANC, into doing what they want to do. They've made it very, very clear from day, from the time we started really talking to, the issues of positions, the issues of principles, of proportionality, issues of, what do you do when you're talking about power sharing? What do you do when you're talking about dispute resolution? That, you know, all they wanted to do was to have a firm grip and control as if they've won the election. So we were not strong-armed. We decided on our own that, we will not be able to then bring in the reforms and the changes that we wanted to. And in fact, we are just going to be rubber stamps of the ANC's decisions. I mean, them wanting to hold on to, as I said, to in a cabinet of 11, wanting to hold on to 8 positions. And then, you know, anything that comes in, they would say, well, let's put it to a vote. Not dealing with how do you deal with the dispute resolution? How do you deal with sufficient consensus? These are things that we had said up front, let's deal with those and then find, you know, a suitable mechanism that will be able to then work for all of us.
I spoke to the Premier last week. He said the door is still open to negotiation with your party. Do you plan to take him up on that?
I think that was just more of a stance, Bruce, because I can tell you right now, they would not allow anybody to touch the 7 portfolios that they would want to then, get into. I challenge you to say the DA has accepted that they will take, we'll not even ask for 4, we'll take 3. But the 3 will have to come in from those that have already been allocated to the ANC. And then let's see if they will accept it. We'll take any 3 that is now already in existence that is coming to any of that is now sitting with them. And you realize that they were not being honest about it. They were just merely, trying to do a PR exercise because now, they have been exposed to for what they have actually then tried to do from day one.
So depending on what you've just told me, you're not ruling out conversation going forward?
We will not rule out any conversation, but at the same time, we are not going to be going in just to be rubber stamping, ANC's decisions. That's not what, we're all about.
What is your position regarding the deputy speakership of the province?
Well, the deputy speaker has resigned because there was an agreement.
And the premier says, no, he wants her back.
No, but you cannot want somebody back if what we had said, because there was supposed to be a deputy speaker, there's supposed to be a chair of chairs, and there's supposed to be 6 chairpersons of portfolios that are supposed to then be coming from the DA. So that is, those positions are supposed to be complementary to each other, because we wanted to make sure that we're able to then hold the MECs of the ANC to account. And you can only do that if you're having a chairperson of a portfolio coming from a different party to that which the MEC holds. So if you're having an ANC MEC, you want to make sure that you have a deputy or you have a chairperson then being a chairperson of a portfolio coming from a different party, number one. Number two, you also want to make sure that we reform the working of the legislature, because the legislature has actually been hollowed out itself. I mean, you're having meeting for the sake of meetings, but if you were to look at how many laws have been made, how many resolutions have actually then gone through, and the impact on the people, you realize that you need those positions to be filled up, not just one position somewhere at the top.
Solium Simanga, thank you very much indeed, leader of the Democratic Alliance in the province of Gauteng.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at midday.
Now, there's no doubt that digital technology has hugely improved healthcare, and in many ways, it is going to change our lives for the better. So to what end, then, is new work being done on key areas that need to be fixed before real progress can be made? A new study is out, and one of the main problems identified is an inability to share data instantly, and also the ability of systems to speak to each other, as well as data security and infrastructure. It's a big topic. Professor Tibani Mashamba-Thompson, Deputy Dean of Research and Postgraduate Studies at the University of Pretoria, is with us now. And how, firstly, then, has digital technology improved healthcare, particularly in this concept called point of care diagnostics?
Thank you very much for this interview and then also for this important question. So digital technology, obviously, in a global context, it has made a huge improvement in healthcare in multiple ways. So when we look at, just give an example of the COVID-19 response era, where it was important to detect cases and also, inform surveillance systems, the digital technologies were enabled the effective surveillance of the pandemic. So, and also beyond COVID-19, if you look at this in the South African context, our, you know, HIV, digital technology is incorporated in the surveillance of HIV in our country. That has been really effective, although it's not really accessible to all, but in many areas it has been used for HIV surveillance and, you know, also to manage maternal health outcomes as well. There was a digital technology system that was used also, you know, for vertical transmission, to manage the vertical transmission system for HIV. That was enabled also by technology incorporated with point of care diagnostics.
Professor, your research group has done studies on point of care diagnostics in sub-Saharan Africa. As far as that is concerned, in terms of development and application, do you think we are ahead or behind the bigger curve?
We are very much still behind, you know, because I have a privilege of traveling all around the world in developed countries, or I would say advanced countries, and then I get to see their technological advancements. If you just look at South Africa and compare it with just the African continent, other countries here, we are advanced in South Africa. But if you look at the continent, Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, maybe, and then compare it with the countries outside of sub-Saharan Africa that are advanced, we are still lagging behind. Obviously, we lack resources and infrastructure to enable us, but I think there's hope for us, but we're still very much behind. Mm.
Professor, what immediate steps then would be needed to close that gap that you refer to, particularly in terms of infrastructure, I guess, skills and also funding, I imagine?
Yeah, it would be important, you know, upskilling our youth. I mean, we have the highest of our population is youth, and most of them are digitally inclined. They like the digital technology and all of this. So, but, you know, upskilling them and also improving access to the technology itself, and also incorporating, you know, technology teaching technology in our curriculum as well, in all curriculum, incorporating it, that would be important. Also, you know, investment by government and private institutions into technological, in ensuring that we have the best of infrastructures to enable the technology that we need.
Professor, what kind of measures are necessary, in your opinion, to ensure data security and privacy in digital healthcare initiatives? It is important, I imagine, for building trust within the healthcare system.
Yeah, absolutely. Data security is very important. And, you know, patient data particularly is very sensitive and it must be protected by all means. So just to ensure that it's not accessed by unauthorized parties and get misused. So it's very much important that we adhere to the POPIA Act that South Africa has just updated recently, and that, you know, we have clear policies as well and adhere to data protection regulations. So it's very much important that we protect patient data, particularly I'm talking in my context. I know there's other data outside of my field. Yeah. So it really helps build trust, and also to ensure that, you know, when we implement our digital initiatives, people don't start worrying that you know that these digital initiatives are risky and it means we'll just won't make any progress if we don't ensure data security and privacy.
And Professor, final question to you. As this entire concept progresses, and what I'm hearing you say is progress very quickly, in terms of change in medical healthcare, what's your vision? How do you see this improving the lives of people in the short to medium term?
If we were to adopt digital technology and scale it up, especially in the context of diagnostics, this would really help countries, you know, have effective surveillance systems. It would help improve access to healthcare for people who have poor access to laboratory infrastructure, and also really improve health outcomes in the long run, and also reduce the burden on our health system. Because, I mean, diseases would be detected early and addressed early, and you know, and then beyond just at individual level, the country will benefit from having a healthier population.
Well, it does sound like a bright future. Professor, thank you very much for joining me on the program today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The use of drones in agriculture is becoming increasingly common as these unmanned aircraft are proving to be a valuable tool in precision farming, a technique involving the analysis and consideration of several factors to determine the correct inputs for maximum outcome. So how is all of this working and what are the advantages? Kopano Tolo is a drone expert at I2 Special Risks and joins me on the program now. So firstly then, how widespread is the adoption of drone technology among the South African farming community? And I'm wondering what factors then are driving this trend.
So we're seeing a huge uptake in the agricultural space of drone technology, as this is also helping farmers improve their yield in production, as well as assisting them in better efficiently running their farms. So i.e. Some usages which we see these drones being used are crop monitoring and health assessment, soil analysis, irrigation management, planting and seeding, as well as the spraying and application of agrochemicals itself.
And obviously this brings with it huge economic benefit.
Definitely, it brings economic benefits to the farmers themselves, as this helps them to improve their efficiency. And from a data perspective, it helps them analyze their data and plan accordingly in terms of their farming season or their spraying season as well. So this efficiently helps them save from the traditional farming methods, as well as assist them in data and making precise decisions in terms of how to tackle certain incidents which they face in the agricultural space.
It really is quite astonishing how the whole notion of agriculture is changing. If you want to be a farmer these days, you've got to be in the fields, but also behind a laptop.
Definitely. I think with that being said, just as mentioned previously in one of the articles I did say, we attended NAMPO, and NAMPO 2024, you could actually tell from the theme which they had there. It was agriculture in the digital era. So this holistically also tells you a lot about how farming itself is moving into a digital era where farmers themselves are in the field but also are needed behind the laptop to make precise decisions and analysis in terms of their farms as well.
That's in fact called something, it's called our precision farming. You've outlined the tasks in terms of what that means, but is there any measurable data to see how efficiency is being improved in this respect?
I'd say on myself, thanks for the question, Jeremy. It's actually a lovely question. So the data itself is in the yield of what the farmers are actually getting. So hence going back to the saying, the proof is in the pudding from the farmers' benefits, the benefits they are actually receiving from using these drones in terms of the precision application of the inputs itself. So they are able to get that data to make the precise, smart farming decisions that are needed for them.
You also talk about drones improving the traceability of food products from farm to plate. What is that, and why would that be important for the end user?
So this is when I talk about the farm to plate phenomenon. Hence, so this obviously improves the traceability of what is actually sprayed onto some of the crops which are being plowed. So from that, it boosts the efficiency of the resource in the management and through the face of the economic conditions of what we as consumers at the end of the day, we know exactly what these people are able to spray onto these farms.
To what extent is cost an issue here? Is it an expensive setup for any farmer?
So at I2, obviously, from what we have seen from the request from the farming agricultural space we've seen, so the technology also improves every single year with what the drones can do and the capabilities of the drones. So of recent effects, this could come to a price of around about 200,000 upwards per unit for the farmers themselves.
You also make the point about the importance of drone insurance then.
Definitely. The importance of drone insurance in the agricultural space and to make sure that the farmers themselves have a peace of mind that the equipment is adequately covered. So at I2, we provide that insurance and that peace of mind for the clients themselves, because a client can face first-party damage by damaging a drone. Any incident can happen whilst you're flying. And furthermore, there's other risk exposures which you would have. So you'd have a third-party liability incident which might occur from you spraying on a farmer's farm.
And what is the projected growth, do you think, of the drone market in South Africa? And I'm assuming that the trajectory is upwards. So what impact is this going to have on the agricultural sector in coming years?
From research, obviously, that we do as a company at I2, from a research firm, we picked up information from ARC recently revealed that local small drone farmers is growing at a trajectory rate of around about 20. This has been predicted from 2020 to 2025. We're seeing an annual growth around about 22.35% upwards.
And is this technology something that is just being deployed by Big Agri, or is this also something for the small and, I guess, developing farmer? And the reason why I ask you that is a 200,000 rand outlay initially is expensive, but I guess there are cheaper products.
Definitely. So what I've seen on my side from my research is this technology is actually filling the gap and helping small-scale farmers. And as we have seen, and as you've mentioned, 200,000 for a small upcoming farmer might be a pricey exercise for them to invest in or start in as a business process. So we have seen the small-scale farmers starting with rather a smaller drone. And from the smaller drone, understanding the technology and through certain partnerships with local crop spraying companies and government in institutions, they are able to assist these small-scale farmers with taking them through or revealing this drone technology within the small-scale farmers. So holistically, what I'm just trying to say, there is a partnership which is currently working. There is initiatives which are out there from the agricultural farming space to assist in incorporating this technology to small-scale farmers or people who have never seen this technology in their farm. So it assists and alleviates that, and it brings them up to par.
Well, that certainly is a glimpse of the future as far as the agricultural sector is concerned. Kopana Tolo, a drone expert at I2 Special Risks, thank you very much for joining me today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Research from Investec and the Gordon Institute of Business Science shows that South Africa has one of the lowest saving rates globally, currently at a staggering 16.5%. This is a far cry from historical rates of 25 to 30% that coincided, obviously, with stronger economic growth. In conversation now with Samantha Moyana from National Debt Advisors, who says South Africans need to prioritize saving despite the myriad economic challenges that we're facing. So what then are the primary factors contributing to this low savings rate? Thank you very much for joining us.
Low household savings can impact individuals' financial stability and the nation's ability to fund in many ways, such as maybe inability to absorb financial shock. Without sufficient savings, household may struggle to absorb financial shocks, such as job losses, medical emergencies, or car repairs, leading to debt accumulating and financial distress. So also, like, with low household savings can limit consumer spending, as they may not have the funds to invest in goods and services, potentially slowing economic growth.
And do you think historically we're in a worse position now than we have been in the past?
Yes, with the rate now historically of 25% to 30% that coincided with a stronger economic growth, yeah.
Warnings have been sounded about this for years now. Why do you think nothing changes?
I believe that maybe also the inflation that's not being stabilized. So it has been affecting a lot of people. Imagine, like, for the past few years, we've been having inflation rising. So now people never got time to actually plan their finances accordingly. Every time you just need to keep adjusting, need to cut down on certain expenses to cover for certain debt repayments. So I think that's what has been affecting. And also the rate of unemployment or job losses is also another contributing factor.
Is it just low-income households that are impacted?
No, every income household, because obviously whoever, the more money you earn, you obviously have maybe a lot of debt obligations. When inflation rises, it affects everyone. Maybe some people still have money to still cut down on or still have money to even cater to accommodate for a new installment. But people that are mostly affected is low-income households, whereby they don't even have money that they're saving aside, and then they really have to cut down on certain things that are also part of the essentials.
Are there new policy changes or incentives, do you think, that can be introduced by the new government to promote a better culture of savings?
I feel that they need to, like, literally implement and maybe, like, look deep into the inflation. I understand the country is currently now at economic growth of 5.4, but I feel like they need to just find a way of also stabilizing it and people now to finally adjust on their current financial expenses, because not every job or people get salary increases each and every single year. And even though people do get that certain percentage, it's not as much as how the inflation has been rising.
It's not just about individual impact. The low savings rate, I imagine, is also impacting more on the ability of South Africans to start businesses and even on a larger scale to fund infrastructure projects.
Yes, definitely. You're right on that one. Because with limited funds for investment and national priorities such as infrastructure, education, so it is affecting a lot of things. It's not necessarily affecting people individually. Business-wise, you know, when inflation is quite high, consumers' time of purchasing goods and services will be low. And meaning that obviously money going towards the JD, the gross domestic product, won't be as much as whereby when people has the buying power.
The astonishing set of numbers as far as savings are concerned also point to household debt nearing 2 trillion rand. But we are now facing this concept of the two-pot retirement system, which effectively means early retirement fund withdrawal to manage their debt. All well and good, but that comes with its own set of inherent risk, doesn't it?
Yes, definitely. Obviously, early retirement withdrawals may lead to penalties and taxes, which will reduce the potential long-term growth. You understand? Because you will be penalized if you're going to access your funds when they haven't reached the maximum term. So reinvesting funds can also help to continue making them grow, because preserving retirement funds ensure more secure financial future. So if people are considering, obviously, on withdrawing some of their funds, they need to know or have a purpose as to why they're withdrawing it. Rather use that money to good use and not access much of it, because you need to consider what will happen by the time you reach retirement stage. How much funds are you going to have more? So I think people need to maybe consult financial advisors so that they can actually, when they do take that route, they know as to why.
Are there specific steps then leading on from that your company recommends employers take to encourage and facilitate savings among their employees? Something that big organizations don't necessarily have a good track record with when it comes to that kind of assistance and facilitation.
The few strategies that I might give is, for example, pause before buying. You know, sometimes we can be a bit impulsive when it comes to purchasing things. You know, that is why it's very important, maybe when you do go for shopping, write down that list and then you stick to it. That will teach you some bit of discipline. And to spread out big expenses, instead of maybe waiting for your December bonus in order to go on holiday, how about maybe you put money aside each and every single month, and then by December you have saved X amount of money that doesn't actually have to go off maybe from your bonus, you know. And also maybe try online shopping. Maybe people, you can be more disciplined if you buy online compared to going to a store. You'll be tempted seeing a lot of things, then you will find yourself buying things that were not part of your plan.
I am going to leave it there, and thank you so much for the good advice, Samantha Muyana from National Debt Advisors. I do appreciate your time. And that's where we're going to leave it for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.